Welcome to the Applied Blockchain Podcast, where blockchain technology and innovation are in the spotlight. My name is Adi Benari, and I'm the founder and CEO of Applied Blockchain, and I'll be your host as we dive into relaxed conversations with industry experts and thought leaders to get their views on what they're building, the Web3 ecosystem, and its transformative impact on the modern world. Graham Rothwood, welcome to the Applied Blockchain Podcast. Great to have you on.
Yeah, Adi, great to be here. Thank you.
Graham is the founder and CEO of Archax. Graham, tell us a little bit about your journey, what you were doing before, what made you found Archax?
Sure. Yeah, I've spent most of my career in asset management, about 20 years in asset management, always in the regulated space, got interested in Bitcoin in 2013, kind of started out as a bit of a hobby, and like a lot of these things, when you start looking at it, you become more interested. And then around 2017, 2018, kind of through the ICO boom, started thinking, actually, this technology looks like it could be applicable to every asset class out there. And if that's true, then this technology is actually going to change financial services. And then once you start believing that, you start to say, okay, well, what will happen? And then you start thinking, well, the whole of financial services will move, institutions will come, and when they do, they'll be looking for a regulated counterparty. Right. So myself and I was the COO at the hedge fund, the CTO and the CFO. We left to set up Archax with a view to create a credible venue institutions could face. So it's 5 years ago now in 2018. And in that time, we applied to the FCA to become regulated, became the UK's first regulated digital securities exchange, custodian broker, and got the UK's first crypto asset registration. So it's been quite a journey getting everything in place. But whilst it's probably been quite slow moving, everything in the space seems to be moving towards institutional and regulation.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're seeing a lot of that ourselves, I guess, from our perspective. What was it about the tech, though, or about what was the thing that you saw that made you think this needs to be applied to regulated assets, or this is going to change things?
It's two things, really. So the first was I was mainly an operations guy, so I spent my life in finance and operations just reconciling. So whenever one of our traders did a trade, you know, the whole back office would go and reconcile it. We'd agree with prime brokers, custodians, administrators. And kind of why is the reason for that? And the two main reasons is no one trusts each other, so everyone keeps their own books and records. And what those records really are ledgers. So everyone runs their own centralized ledger. And of course, if you take the idea that when a transaction happens, imagine everyone could see the same transaction, then you're gone with all reconciliation. So that was the kind of, you know, and it's not perfect and there's a lot of work to get there, but you kind of start going, okay, if everyone can see it, then actually, you know, it's indisputable what the transaction was. That was the first point. The second point is something we realized, which I'm still not sure everyone's realized, is that this isn't really a new asset class. Everyone talks about digital assets and crypto assets. What it really is a technology. It's a technology of ownership in my mind. So anything in the world can have who owns it. And it can be a cap table, it can be a building, you know, it can be your own individual object, whatever it is, someone owns it. And that register of ownership can be on a bit of paper, can be on a spreadsheet, in a database. And we kind of figured early on, well, the only difference here is it's on a blockchain. So what that means is that the regulation is there. For the most part, if you want to do digital securities, the securities regulation is there. If you want to trade commodities, the commodities regulation is there. And of course, it may need tweaking for this technology. But if you work along the lines of follow the regs for the underlying asset class, you usually end up in a decent place.
Yeah. Okay, great. We work together, but we've never really spoken about things in these terms before. But we're completely on the same page. If somebody asked me the same question, I'd probably give similar answers. I mean, the technical efficiency of having that record, the different parties honor as the record of ownership. That's I think the sort of fundamental underlying thing on which everything else is built and on which you can really get the efficiencies that you're talking about. That's how we see it, and also the primary use of the blockchain as a record of ownership.
Exactly.
I think that's really what it's about. And I think there's been lots of experimentation using it, maybe more data and for other things, but fundamentally it's accounts and transfers of things between accounts.
Exactly. They are accounts within a chart of accounts, and they're transactions. And, you know, as a qualified accountant, it pleases me that technology and accounting has kind of come together in this way, because everything I used to account for, I can pretty much do on a blockchain.
Yeah. And I think with that, there's also the business case for using the blockchain for that. And in the first place, is really where you've got a record of ownership, that obviously has some value associated with it because you want it to be secure. Otherwise, the ownership record itself is at risk. So, and therefore, your ownership of the asset. So I think that with that comes the business case for actually using this type of technology.
Exactly.
To keep things secure in the first place and to have that level of trust that then allows you to have the reconciliation efficiencies on top.
Exactly. So, you know, the companies are driven by profit, and the ways you make profit are selling more or being more efficient. And being more efficient, you know, can open new markets. So small companies trying to move into capital markets are sometimes constrained because of the high cost. But if you can bring that cost down, you suddenly open up capital markets and start expanding the potential for other firms. So there's, you know, it does democratize. I know people use that word a lot, but it does really open up the world.
That's meaningful.
It makes it more available. Yeah. And I think when people are talking about the benefits of crypto, they often talk about, you know, the fractionalization, democratization, 24/7. And like, it's kind of true, but to be honest, in the hedge fund world, I could have always created an SPV, let you buy and sell it 24/7 and fractionalized anything by putting it, like, you know, that's where some of the benefits. More to your point, when you've got this on a blockchain, the power of that is quite significant. Letting someone custody their own assets, maybe use them as collateral, especially when you've got a digital currency, having that delivery versus payment on chain, corporate actions, dividends payments, fixed income payments directly to a wallet of someone's own custody without losing intermediary inefficiencies along the way. Yeah. You know, that's, and we're not quite there yet, but that's definitely the direction of travel. And that's when everyone's going to suddenly realize for sure this was the right thing for everyone to do.
Yeah, I agree. I also think when you have that efficiency and take out a lot of that friction, that brings with it liquidity as well. So that's something that we saw, you know, albeit in a somewhat silly way with the NFTs, but you could see taking assets that were, some of them, you know, that we worked with were physical assets, and you suddenly brought liquidity to a market that just wasn't there before.
Yeah. And regulation, you know, people talk about regulation as constraining the market, and there are people that need protecting, and I'm obviously a big supporter of regulation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, things like NFTs or maybe Robinhood, eToro, these platforms which make the user close to the market, what you're also realizing in, there's been a transition in recent generations. People want to trade their own stuff and be closer to the market. Mm-hmm. And if you can make these products more accessible, they will develop liquidity if they're interesting. Yeah. So getting rid of those intermediary layers, making markets more accessible and creating interesting products, people will trade them and bring liquidity.
Yeah. I also think if you look at what happened in the last 2 or 3 years, the number of people, especially young people, who played with crypto, maybe for all sorts of reasons, but actually got their hands in it and were actually playing with assets that were sitting in their wallets, were maybe trading and learning some of the basics of trading, and being able to do it directly themselves. It's an education, it's an experience for a whole audience here that, yes, crypto kind of goes up and down, but there's some stuff that just, you know, educates people and gets them closer to it, and they experience that I don't think is going to go away.
Right, yeah, I couldn't agree more. And there's kind of a few elements to that. So, you know, people on Twitter and the like, you know, you follow some of these people, and they've been trading crypto for ages, and ordinarily you probably wouldn't have thought of them as an investment analyst. But the sorts of insight that you can get from people I've never met, and the way they analyze the market, the ability of people to go into chain transactions and track them and give you insights and point out exploits in the code.
Yeah.
There's some phenomenal brains out there that ordinarily probably wouldn't have gone into a financial market.
Yeah.
And now they are. And part of that is because it's something that interests them. So, you know, they don't really want to read an analyst report from a bank and pay their broker a fee. But if they can go and read something and invest directly themselves with minimal slippage and hold it themselves, it's pretty powerful.
Yeah, it's just it's accessibility, isn't it? And people have kind of got a feel for it now. So I think it's out there. But I guess there's always that friction between, let's say, the, you know, that kind of open public blockchain and crypto, where, you know, things obviously got out of control at some point as well. And the regulated world, and let's say the enterprise and institutional world. How do you reconcile that?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard, right? There's, kind of to the point earlier, there's, if you think every asset in the world can be on a blockchain, then you've already got regulated and unregulated assets. So I think for the regulated assets, equity and whatever, like, the regulations are there for a reason. No country or regulator is sitting there and saying, we really want to stifle innovation. What they're really saying is, we need to protect consumers because we want our economy to look like a good financial economy. That's what they want. So, you know, no one wants FTX or Voyager or anything like that to happen on their watch. Mm-hmm. So consumers do need protecting. But I think quite where the line stops, that's quite challenging. So equity, debt for sure, commodities, you know, what is Bitcoin, is a conversation, like it's quite hard. So drawing those lines of which assets to protect, I think, is key. And on a personal level, you know, a lot of people in crypto like the anonymity of it all. But, you know, having spent my life in regulated financial services, I've had it kind of drummed into me that there is the potential to be funding financial crime, you know, whatever it might be, weapons, child pornography, slavery, whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, it's fine to go and trade places where no one knows anyone, but you need to know for sure that you might be funding something you don't agree with, you know. And for me, regardless of the project, I would always like to know that the appropriate checks are being done on who's been traded. And I am actually quite happy to trust someone that information will never be released. Yeah, I mean, there's been enough crypto firms that have, you know, been hacked and released user information anyway. So I don't think that should be our big concern. I think, you know, by having open and honest conversations with the regulators, you can say, okay, like, do you all agree that mining shouldn't be regulated, for example, but digital security should be regulated as much as securities? Yeah. And then for sure, bad actors. I mean, that needs to, bad actors are bad actors wherever they are. You know, FTX, I think the crazy thing about that was great system. You know, like, I kind of looked up to them as a great operating system. How did they do it? Such a cool company. I mean, you know, the following on Twitter, Sam's ability to move markets, but, you know, finding out underneath it all that, you know, I mean, what they were saying was completely untrue. There was no governance, you know.
It was almost managing it on QuickBooks and
it feels like the whole thing was a GUI and nothing was on the back end anymore. You know, stuff like that just shouldn't exist. And like everyone kind of says, it's not where we want crypto to go, but it's fine. But how do you stop that? Yeah. You need some controls in place. And I think ultimately the crypto digital world will be a better place if we have better controls in place, but we somehow work out how we leave the fluidity of it all, like zero knowledge proofs. I know we've talked about in the past, you know, if we can work out a way of knowing who we deal with but without necessarily sharing of information, like that feels like a good place to be.
I agree. It's interesting. I think from a technical perspective, I can look at this, and also thinking about it from like the crypto community and kind of where things started and Bitcoin and Ethereum and so on. I think there's an element of people that believe that the technology itself can give some levels of protection, and therefore there's less, or some would say no need for regulation. And I think like most of these things, the truth is probably somewhere in the middle, right? The technology can probably take care of a lot of things that the regulator thinks needs manual process or reporting processes in place. Maybe some of that could be shifted to the technology. But then there's other things that obviously need regulation, right? Like, what is the asset, and is it really, you know, what's behind it? What are the claims behind it, and these kind of things.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And as you say, some of the things about the parties you're dealing with, right? Maybe you don't have to know exactly who they are, but you need to know that who they're not or what they're not doing.
I guess life for me is if statements, right? If it's raining and I wear a coat, if this, then that. Like, everything in life to me is an if statement. And you can say the same about regulation and law, like, if high net worth, then this, if retail, then that.
Yeah.
All of those codes per jurisdiction theoretically can be put into a smart contract where you can say, okay, if their bank shows they're wealthier than this, if they work here, like, you can put it all in there. The reality is, in the 5 years since we've been going, there's been a lot of talk about what smart contracts can do, but most of them are dumb tokens that I see. Like, they move from one place to another.
Yeah.
Like, you might have a whitelist in, and there's some DeFi stuff that, you know, is a bit more automated, you know, and like, you know, mainly in DeFi, actually, you see it. But most of the tokens that we still come across is, you hold this, it says you own that. So, it's a long way away from be able to create a token that dynamically changes with laws and regulations on a global basis. So, you know, I think we'll still end up with manual intervention, at least for the next 5 to 10 years. But what you'll probably see is, perhaps on like a let's say a fixed income security, you might have an automated distribution of 1% of proceeds or something where they're very fixed criteria. Whereas dividends, someone's going to need to type the profit in, someone's going to need to type the allocation. Like you know, unless you imagine a world where it feeds off the accounting system.
I mean, that's it. I think there's I think first of all, in the same way as you said earlier that the blockchain itself is really a record of ownership, which really manifests itself as ownership of what of assets which are represented as tokens. Then for me, smart contracts are the really some restrictions or rules around when those tokens can move.
Yeah.
Right. That's really all they are. That's all they should be. And so when we see smart contracts like automated market makers like a Uniswap or something like that, or the DeFi contracts, that's essentially what they're doing as well, right? They're receiving some tokens, and there's some rules about when those tokens can move and to whom.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that's the essence of smart contracts. But there's always this interaction with the real world, right? And I think the purists would say, okay, and maybe this is like the blockchain nirvana, is at some point we're all exchanging money in digital form through a ledger, and so maybe our salaries and savings and all our transactions are there. And so when you talk about profits and loss and so on and the value of assets, then that could be derived from that. But we're obviously very, very far from that today. And so that risk, you know, you talk about if statements, it's really a lot of it is risk, isn't it? And it's assessing risk. It's not necessarily binary.
Yeah.
And a lot of that risk, especially when you're dealing with non-native assets, lies off-chain. And so then you're kind of depending on data, information, and parties that are providing that from outside the blockchain.
Yeah, right? And then you start having oracles and price freeze.
Yes, yes, and whatever rules you put into the contract, if somebody who's providing that information from outside it can manipulate it or is a bad actor, then there's nothing the contracts are going to do about it.
Exactly. So we need to look for areas where there is huge friction, huge inefficiencies. You know, a lot of times we're speaking to banks and asset managers.
Yeah.
It's not really the big liquid funds they're interested in. They're like, hey, I've got this infrastructure fund. 7 banks trade it a year. There's a stack of paper like this.
Yeah.
We just want to make that a bit faster. Yeah. You know, the things that trade every day in blue chip stocks, like there's huge money in that.
Yeah.
But like kind of no one's moaning about the settlement process of Apple at the moment. Not really. Like people might have the argument T0, T+2. But, you know, it's making money for everyone involved. I'm not sure everyone's so concerned.
Yeah, we've come across similar things. Also, we've seen this in energy and commodities where there are very liquid markets today. And therefore, they don't see a huge problem. But there are all these illiquid or less liquid markets, which to use, let's say, pre-blockchain technology to try to make them more liquid just didn't compute.
No. There's some fascinating characteristics as well. Like, these stablecoins fascinate me, even though they're super basic. And the reason that they do is because in the hedge fund days, you used to have cash. And you'd have cash if you wanted to trade. But if you knew that you were going to be sitting on cash for a while, you'd probably sweep it into a money market fund or a 30-day fund. But when you did that, you knew you didn't have the cash. What's a bit crazy about this, and I'm still kind of trying to get my head around the benefits of it, is now I can put it in a tokenized Aberdeen money market fund, and I can get a token. Like, I could still use this token. Like, when I used to put it in, I couldn't use it. So now I could potentially use this as a currency pair against Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. I can go and park it in Aave or Balancer and borrow against it. Mm-hmm. And people know the underlying is a money market fund held on Archax, a regulated venue. You know, the benefits of being able to trade those illiquid assets as liquid assets means potentially you've kind of changed the whole paradigm of a liquidity and risk return. So that's like, you know, I think there's some fascinating angles there for someone with more time than me to start looking into.
Yeah. Yeah, no, completely. I think we're just at the beginning of all this, really. Right? But that brings me to the question of Archax. Right? So Archax, you mentioned the first regulated exchange, tokenized assets in the UK. How do you fit into all of this? What's your vision for the company?
Yes, we started off as a secondary market. When we started in 2018, there were a few tokenization companies around. And I think their view was we're going to create tokens. And a lot of them were ERC-20s, but they were also creating security tokens. But they kind of quickly came to realize that that they should probably be regulated, especially if they're distributing. And most of them didn't have distribution networks like investment banks. So the kind of the you know, what we found was, okay, it's not going to be enough for us to have a secondary market. Mm-hmm. We're going to need to raise money as well. So with Archax now, as a company, an SME or a fund or a large company, you can come to us, you can raise money in traditional or digital form, and then we can move you onto our secondary market. So if you're a liquid company, like a, you know, a large blue chip today, you can move on to our MTF. But if it's an SME or a small company,
what's an MTF?
A multilateral trading facility. So it's a type of exchange in the UK. So if you wanted to, you could come and trade on the secondary market. But if you were a smaller company, you could trade on a bulletin board, which is more peer to peer transactions. So, you know, for some things like, you know, a bit of real estate, you know, we're sitting in one kind of the wall here. Let's say this was to be tokenized. Mm-hmm. It's not the case it's suddenly going to trade 10,000 times a second. But people that bought it would like to know that they could at least trade it once a day, once a week if they wanted to. So we're trying to facilitate liquidity of these asset classes. We're trying to enable companies to raise money. And behind it all, we've got a tokenization platform. So if people wanted to come to us, they want to raise money, want to create a token, they want to start explore ways to raise money from kind of, you know, this new distribution model, then we can help them with that.
Okay. So I guess to ask some dumb questions, you know, because I'm, you know, thinking just from a techie, so I'm not that familiar with some of this. But if I think about like going, you know, when a company wants to go public on a stock exchange, you know, there's a certain level of activity and revenue and all sorts of parameters that they have to get to before that becomes relevant.
Yeah.
How does that work in terms of Archax?
Yeah. So in the UK, there are two main types of markets. One's called an RIE, like the London Stock Exchange.
Yeah.
So that's where you go for your full listing, or Aquis have one as well. And then you can go to somewhere that has an MTF, multilateral trading facility. So an MTF like us can only admit things for listing, for trading that have already been listed elsewhere. So I can add Vodafone tomorrow because it's already been listed on the London Stock Exchange. The problem with that is that, you know, in our world, there's a lot of small companies, a lot of startups, they're never going to be able to satisfy the listing rules.
Yeah.
Now, luckily in the UK, there's something called the SME growth market. So you can apply to be one, which means that you can as good as ignore those listing rules and set your own appropriate rules for SMEs. So Archax has this. So let's say Apply Blockchain or Archax wanted to come to Archax to be admitted for trading. You wouldn't have to follow the listing rules.
Right.
You need to follow Archax's issuer rules. And you need to satisfy the criteria of an SME, which is basically a balance sheet of under 200 million, more or less.
Mm-hmm. That's not a problem for us. Yeah,
for most companies in the space, it's really not a problem at all. And actually, you're allowed some companies that are over as long as the majority of your venue is an SME. So, you know, so what we're trying to do is make capital markets more accessible. And in the past, SME growth markets have struggled a bit because they're small companies and there's no community.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you look at companies like Crowdcube and Cedars, they're great at building communities, investing in these small companies. But then kind of what happens is most people get excited, they invest, and then they sit there going, kind of what happens now? And a lot of these companies fade away, or you can't trade out of them. And even if they do well, you can't trade out of them. Yeah. So you've kind of got community and fundraising here and secondary markets on SME growth markets. So Archax has kind of brought those together. So over time, as we start developing trading, hopefully we'll build communities around some of these companies raising money so that when they trade on the secondary market, there's some liquidity and some interest as well.
Okay, that sounds like a little bit of maybe the let's say the positive dynamics of what's happening in crypto in terms of building communities around projects and teams and so on. But obviously, with the regulation around that and the sort of safeguards and so on.
Yeah, well, the SEC came out yesterday against Bittrex actually and said, look, you're running an exchange, a broker, a custodian, a clearinghouse, all in the same place. There's reasons these should be segregated, and actually, a lot of the FTX fallout. People were talking about it's because they had the custodian and the exchange together. Yeah. I don't agree with it. It may not be helpful, but the problem was really that bad actors, no governance, no controls and processes. Mm-hmm. If you trade in most prime brokers today, you know, or your custodian, you custody your, you know, I use Hargreaves Lansdown with my own personal pension. Like my cash is there. They place trade. They're kind of my custodian, my execution agent in the same place. Like, and I trust that it's happening because they're a regulated entity and they have governance in place. And I think even if Sam was just running your custodian, there's a good chance he would have taken your assets and gone and staked them or done something else with them. So
yeah, I mean, in his case, it was Almeida that was the, it was the relationship with Almeida that was also the,
exactly. The it's, yeah, people are kind of going, oh, it's because they were together. It's not, it's nothing, it's, mm-hmm. like, no, if they were regulated, if they had my chairman and my board there, yeah. and people had said, we're thinking of doing this, we've got no way. There's just no way you're going to be using clients' assets to lend off to your sister firm that has a completely different ownership structure. So,
yeah.
You know, I think that, I think, unfortunately, that's overblown because, to your point, I think absolutely one of the benefits of crypto was the likes of Binance come along and they're like, and you know, I don't agree with the way that they run their business, but you have mm-hmm. to have to go, you know what, this guy has a risk engine, futures, equity, arguably, crypto, the front end, the custodian, it's global, and it all operates on far fewer people than some of our giant financial infrastructures, and there's high liquidity. Now, is it all legit? Mm-hmm. I don't know. But certainly when something gets added there, it has liquidity yeah. and more liquidity than it would get in small growth markets around the world. And for mm-hmm. and for small companies looking to raise money, that has to be an attractive, we, you know, we should be looking at that going, that can really help small companies around the world. What is good about that that we can replicate? And that's the kind of thing we're trying to do.
Right. I mean, if I look at them in particular, then I guess from a tech perspective, they, you know, they haven't got a lot of the technical safeguards in place for what they're doing, right? It looks a little bit like FTX in that sense,
yeah.
from a tech perspective. And on the other side, they also haven't got the regulation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you know, they're kind of missing both sets of protections.
Yeah, right? I think there's you know, the Artax journey is yeah. let's get the regulations and then build a business.
Yeah.
Commercially, that hasn't been as easy a choice as others who've said, let's try and make enough money to pay the fines in the future.
Yep.
So, you know, my view is that a lot of those companies that went hard early going offshore doing what they liked,
yeah.
you know, they're now, you can see them now gradually increasing the quality of the jurisdiction they're moving to, having discussions with local government saying, hey, look, we're trying to be legitimate. And I don't think that's a strong message for institutions in the future that you started badly and you got better. So yep. we've always yep. tried to say, look, we'll do it right first time, but there yep. is no doubt. Certainly when I see the signs of, you know, in the US, there's been some companies that I've looked at the size of the fines compared to how much they made. And I was like, come on, that's, you know, from the company's point of view, that was a really good trade. yeah.
All right. Yeah. Wow. Okay, good. Okay, I think we've covered a lot of ground there.
Yeah, to be fair,
I mean, we can. I'm just thinking in terms of we can edit, but just thinking, is there anything else you want to cover that I haven't covered in there?
Yeah, talk about the system a bit. Have you got the system stuff? Actually, I'm going to link your stuff in a bit.
Okay, I guess just thinking about the technology. I mean, what have you done in terms of blockchain? You know, what are your choices and why? And maybe give us a little bit of insight into that.
Yeah, I guess you know, whilst we love blockchain, a lot of what we built is not blockchain, just because of the nature of what we're building, really. So we started off thinking we'll connect into other players. So, you know, we partnered with Aquis in London to provide our securities matching engine. They've been a good partner, and we had others mm-hmm. in our stack, but it just didn't really work to connect them all together, and it was quite a slow way of working. So in the end, we've ended up building quite a lot. So we've built our own front end, our own AML KYC system, our own custodian sitting on top of Metaco. And we're still connected into Aquis, but we have our own 24/7 matching engine as well that we can use for crypto. So we've kind of put all that together. And then along the way, I guess when we started off, we've always kind of said, look, we're going to try and be chain agnostic. But not because, you know, we're trying to leave all options open, but just because everyone moves around so fast. Like in the early days, you know, we kind of went, oh, everyone's building on Corda. Then it was like, oh, it's on, you know, Hyperledger. Oh, everyone's on Ethereum. Oh, Polygon, Avalanche. Like it moves around so fast. It's impossible. And, you know, what's interesting is it always seems to come back to Ethereum.
Yeah.
And I think the reason for that is that, you know, what they've done well, Consensus, Ethereum, Foundation, whoever, is that getting a MetaMask wallet's easy, DeFi protocols are there, chain analytics is easy,
yeah.
spinning up tokens is easy. So whenever I speak to the other layer ones, they just still don't seem to be investing enough in that base layer, which yeah. makes adoption yeah. really difficult. So, you know, we've worked with Algorand, Hedera, R3. Like, we love our partners, and I still see people going to Ethereum. So we've built a tokenization engine. The Pi blockchain have obviously been a big part of that. So, you know, really happy that we've done that. And we can now tokenize on Ethereum, Polygon, Hedera, Algorand. And I think being able to do that gives us the flexibility that when an issuer comes to us and says, hey, I really want to make use of you know, this specific virtue of this chain, we can go, okay, that's okay, we can put it there. The challenge we have is that, you know, we're also speaking to Stella or Startware or whoever it is, and, you know, I guess we're increasingly trying not to be led by what we think is interesting and just looking commercially what people are working on.
Yeah.
And there's still this private public debate, you know, which I guess for the benefit of your listeners is you've got the big banks. Everyone kind of thinks public's going to be a big part of the future, but the big banks tend to kind of be restricted from what they can do on chain still. So you've got all this stuff happening on Ethereum, but yet some of them are building their own private networks. Some of them are working on private chains. I personally don't see how these, you know, layer ones built internally ever really fulfill the full promise of crypto. So I hope somehow they converge. And the full promise of what I think, just so you know, is that you have, I'm going to start with a central counterparty, but it might not be central, as a counterparty that knows everyone in the world. And, you know, that's like the oracle that has all the data on everyone, and then those people are accessible to trade anything, anywhere, whatever they want. So, you know, we're obviously, you know, on the engine that we built together, going through AML, KYC, and giving people whitelists and enable them to trade. In theory, if we had everyone in the world, we'd be able to sit back and see the transactions happening between people we know and make sure they're tracked accordingly. And for me, that resolves most of the regulatory issues that exist out there.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Wow. There's quite a lot packed into that. I guess in terms of the tech, I mean, we've obviously kind of lived through this since 2015 now. We started when Ethereum wasn't even launched yet. I think it was just being publicized. But the thing I loved about Ethereum specifically, if I look at their journey even through to now, is they kind of stuck to their principles, especially on the tech side. So they, when all these other blockchains came along, really as Ethereum beaters, right, saying Ethereum wasn't fast enough, was too expensive, etc. Ethereum could have they could have bent in different directions, but they didn't really. They stuck to their principles and they've kept it very decentralized. They haven't really compromised on these very important things, which boil down to security. And I think security is the thing that's super important there, because that's the trust layer, right? That's how you want to know your assets are safe.
Yeah.
On that ledger. So I think that's really the key for me, for really why I think now when we're seeing a bit of contraction in the market, we're seeing sort of people going back to the safer platforms, which include Ethereum. But it's a very dynamic space, right? You know, we've seen, like you say, you've named some of the platforms, and we've just seen movement here, then movement there, and there's certainly a lot of these platforms have a lot of interesting technical properties, some innovations of their own, some very good teams on some of them. So it's very difficult to predict as well going forward. I mean, again, we're looking at it, you mentioned Starkware, we look at zero knowledge proofs now, and the fact that they can be anchored in Ethereum, it can give you scale off it. We're also thinking about how that can be used potentially by enterprises who previously didn't want to or had issue with connecting directly to a public chain or transacting directly on a public chain. So I think that the models are evolving.
Yeah, and from the time that you guys set up and I guess us as well, like, you know, it was kind of easy to follow three or four chains before and go, oh, there's a fork happening over here. Well, like, and I'm not a technologist like you are, but I had a good understanding of roughly what they all did. Now, there's no way.
Yeah.
You know, when you know, the Startware guys, like, met them, it's great to get into the real detail of how that's different from anyone else is so challenging. And then, so you've got the forks, you've got the upgrades, you've got to understand how the chain analytics changes, how the custody models change.
Yeah.
You know, what's the native functionality? Which infrastructure providers are they safe? You know, how do they interconnect in the world? What are the bridges that are available? How do they treat wrapped tokens? Which stable coins do they have? Like the questions that you have to ask.
Yeah.
What I've noticed, though, which is, I'm not sure if people talk about it much, but back in 2018, like, you had all these tokens being created and, like, I don't know, like BitBay, whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, these tokens were all over the place, and some of them lived, some of them died. Like, it's like Filecoin had tons of cash. I'm sure they're still around. But what's really apparent to me now is when you look at CoinGecko, or CoinMarketCap, and you look down it, they're pretty much layer ones on stable coins.
Right.
Like, the ones that are surviving and growing are the ones that have community and building on. It's kind of the picks and shovels.
Yep.
It's not really the use cases of them. And I'm sure there's some up there, but a lot of it is the layer ones. And that's because even the institutions, they might not believe in utility tokens or everything, but they're all sure now that tokenization is going to happen. And yep. if you think tokenization is going to happen, and you think it's going to happen on one of these chains, that's actually quite a good bull case for why you need to hold this token for the long term.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I've always been very conservative when it comes to the tokens. And I think it's interesting what you say about the layer one tokens. And I think, and I don't normally talk about this stuff, but you have to really carefully look at the token economics. And for me, the decentralized infrastructure, which is what the layer ones are, there's a case there where there's a fee being paid, the gas fee, and there's outsourced infrastructure parties who are doing the hosting, who are getting paid for that. There's a case for them being paid not by one party that's just paying their invoices or giving them money to cover their cost, but through the system, because that's how you decentralize control.
You're right.
Right? That's how you know they're going to be independent.
Yeah.
Because the system, the software is paying them, and it's not tied to any one party that's dishing out the money and can therefore stop dishing out the money or bribe them or force them to do something or whatever.
Yeah.
That's where I think there's a real model for the token. There's an economic token model for the token as well, because you've got the fee versus the outsourced service, right? It's just a different AWS model.
Yeah.
Right? Some of the other tokens, I don't know whether they have that kind of model and justification behind them for the token
itself, or for the value of the token. It's not clear. Right? And some of, you know, we talked about the communities and the projects earlier, but for sure, like we've seen it 100 times, a lot of times people are investing in projects early because they think the next people are going to invest at a higher value, like pure speculation.
Yeah.
It's not because they're saying, in the future, everyone's going to need this token for X, Y, Z, which is what I think they are saying with the layer ones. I guess layer twos as well. And you probably have a stronger view on this than me, but even lately, if people have been saying to me, do you think layer twos have a good use case if Ethereum and the like are starting to address some of the scaling concerns? And, and that's an interesting point as well. Like, I don't know, because you're right, Ethereum tend to be heading in a good direction.
Yeah, I mean, we've been looking at this carefully. I've actually got one of our most senior guys in the team putting together a report comparing these layer twos and ZK rollups and so on, going in deep and comparing them, because I think that's what we need in order to advise clients on really what we think the best path is or the right thing to do is. When we look at Ethereum's roadmap at the moment, they're actually moving away from hosting transactions, right? So they don't want to be the ones hosting all the regular transactions. They think that should be these layer twos.
Right.
What they want to do is be the place where these transactions get rolled up into, so the sort of trust anchor. And also there's a case for state. So these layer twos, you're taking risk on them and they're holding all of the information about the transactions. If they disappear, then you could be stuck. So there's state that needs to be held or within access or guaranteed by Ethereum itself. So those two things, the kind of proof that the transactions happen and the availability of the information to be able to exit with your funds if something goes wrong in a layer two, that's their focus now.
Right.
And they're not trying to be all things to all people.
Yeah, anymore. And they can, like to your point, continue to focus on the things that matter to them rather than the scalability, which the layer twos are.
Yeah, they're going to be the trust anchor behind the stuff that scales on beyond them.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of their vision if we sort of unpack that.
Good. Good to get a copy of that when it's.
Okay, Graham, super interesting. I guess one last question that I normally ask the guests, if you've got a source of information that you use, whether it's books or podcasts or some kind of, or places that you go to get to sort of stay up to date or get some interesting information that you might want to share with people.
Yeah, I guess, pretty busy. So I kind of driving it from a lot of places. So I read a lot of industry reports, you know, like if you guys issue something, a lot of the law firms issue summaries of consultation papers. And I guess there's some good daily snapshots into the inbox, so the Defiant, Delphi, and Digital Bytes, kind of these things that drop in and kind of keep you abreast of everything. To be honest, I spend, you know, not a fair while of my day, but probably, you know, a few 10-minute slots during the day dropping in and out of Twitter, because you know, Twitter is a fascinating place to just hear a clue before you go off and, you know, find a good source of information that something might be happening. So, I tend to draw it from a lot of sources. In terms of books, you know, not so much reading anymore, but I'm, you know, a big fan of a couple of things like The Tipping Point, how a little bit of extra effort can make a difference, especially when you're in a startup where you really need to give it your all. And a good book called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway, which has kind of changed a bit of the way I do things. So now when my brain says, maybe don't do this, I automatically go, yeah, do this.
I'm going to check that one out.
Yeah, do it.
Okay, fantastic, Graham.
Cheers.
Absolute pleasure.
Thanks, Eddie.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Applied Blockchain Podcast. Make sure you follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter for more updates. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you did, please let us know by leaving a review and clicking subscribe. Until next time.